of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Pat Perry from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the News and Observer. Today's reading of Money Matters is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. Today's stories include Trump insists he can make U.S. companies leave China, and employers say they need more immigrants. And we'll begin with Trump insists he can make U.S. companies leave China. President Donald Trump asserted Saturday that he has the authority to make good on his threat to force all U.S. businesses to leave China, citing a national security law that has been used mainly to target terrorists, drug traffickers, and pariah states like Iran, Syria, and North Korea. As he arrived in France for the annual meeting of the Group of Seven Powers, Trump posted a message on Twitter citing the International Emergency Economic Powers Act of 1977, a law originally meant to enable a president to isolate criminal regimes, not sever economic ties with a major trading partner over a tariff dispute. For all of the fake news reporters that don't have a clue as to what the law is relative to presidential powers, China, etc., try looking at the Emergency Economic Powers Act of 1977, Trump wrote. Case closed. The president's threat to all but cut off one of America's most important trading relationships could disrupt a global economy already on the edge of recession amid his trade war, while further unsettling giant companies in the United States that rely on China in their production and sale of everything from clothing to smartphones. Trump has often made drastic threats as a negotiating ploy to force a partner to offer concessions, as when he vowed to close the border with Mexico or impose tariffs on its goods to force action to halt illegal immigration. But if he were to follow through, it would be the most significant break with China in decades. Trump's claim that he has the power to order U.S. companies to pull out of China also represents the latest assertion of authority by a president who has repeatedly crossed lines that his predecessors have not. While he came to office criticizing President Barack Obama for exceeding the power of his office, Trump has gone even further in creative ways to take action on his priorities. Any invocation of the International Emergency Economic Powers Act in these circumstances and for these purposes would be an abuse, said Daniel Price, a former international economic advisor to President George W. Bush. The act is intended to address extraordinary national security threats and true national emergencies, not fits of presidential pique. Under the weight of Trump's tariffs war, China has already fallen from being the United States' largest trading partner last year to the third largest this year. The United States remains China's largest trading partner. China said Friday that it would raise tariffs on U.S. goods in retaliation for Trump's latest levies, and the president vowed hours later to increase tariffs even further. China's Commerce Ministry issued a strongly worded statement Saturday warning the United States to turn back from ever-escalating confrontation, but it did not threaten any new trade measures. This unilateral and bullying trade protectionism and extreme pressure violate the consensus of the heads of state of China and the United States, violate the principle of mutual respect, equality, and mutual benefit, seriously undermine the multilateral trading system and the normal international trade order, the Chinese statement said. American business leaders in China said Saturday that forcing U.S. companies to leave the country would hurt the competitiveness of U.S. industry and could cause heavy financial loss. And next, employers say they need more immigrants. After finishing a particularly satisfying dinner at Coral Gables, Florida restaurant with his wife, Pedro Martinez quietly slipped around to the back alley where the kitchen is. "Whatever you're making, I'll give you a raise," Martinez whispered when the back door swung open. An executive at 50 Eggs, a restaurant group based in Miami, Martinez is always ready with a stack of business cards for occasions like this. As unemployment rates nationwide have sunk to record lows, filching workers has become routine. In cities that are magnets for immigrants, newcomers have filled some job openings, but employers across several industries and states insist that many more are needed for their businesses to function, let alone grow. The economic effect is just one facet of an immigration debate that vibrates with political and moral import, challenging ideas about America's identity and culture. But it is also one that can be examined more dispassionately by looking at the numbers. And the numbers most economists say indicate there is plenty of room. Immigrants make the country richer, they argue. "Without immigration, we shrink as a nation," said Douglas Holtz Eakin, a former director of the Congressional Budget Office, who has advised Republican presidential candidates and now leads the Conservative American Action Forum. That's because growth is driven by two ingredients: the size of the workforce and how efficiently those workers produce things, and both are creeping well behind the post-war average. One reason is that Americans are having fewer babies. Birth rates fell last year to a three-decade low, ensuring that the next generation of native-born Americans will be smaller than the current one. The result is fewer workers and consumers, fewer houses to build, phones to sell, and cars to buy, fewer gains all around. Turn away new immigrants, and the picture darkens considerably. Using census data, an investment company, the Blackstone Group, estimates that without immigration, the working age population between 25 and 64 years old would drop by 17 million by 2035. "We really need immigrants," Byron R. Wien, vice chairman of Blackstone's Private Wealth Solutions Group, said during the company's quarterly webcast last month. "If we have a shrinking population, it's going to be tough to have rising GDP or gross domestic product." At the moment, there are 7.3 million job openings nationwide and 6 million people unemployed. That gap is expected to widen as the number of retirees grows faster than the number of new workers. "In every market that we're in, we're dealing with staffing shortages," said Pilar Carvajal, founder and chief executive of Innovation Senior Management, which manages 7 assisted living centers in Florida. Entry-level workers in the area make from $10 to $12 an hour, the same as a dishwasher and slightly more than a farm worker. She has turned away business, declining to manage properties elsewhere. "It's a staffing void," she confided during a visit to the Memory Care Center in Broward County. "Employment agencies won't even return phone calls." Thank God we have immigrants coming in, she said. We're hiring them as fast as they come. More than 1 million immigrants enter the United States every year, most of them through authorized channels. Altogether, there are more than 44 million immigrants, or 13.6% of the population. The share is significantly higher than it was in 1970, but below the peak in the 1890s when millions of Europeans crossed the Atlantic Ocean. President Donald Trump has publicly resisted the argument that the nation needs more immigrants. Our country is full, he said during a visit to the border this spring. We can't take any more. But in May, Trump proposed revamping legal immigration without reducing the overall level by giving preference to immigrants with skills, education, and job offers instead of people with family ties. There is no way to figure out precisely how many more immigrants the national economy could easily absorb without a lot of guessing. Powerful forces like technology, globalization, and the decline in union strength can heave economies around willy-nilly, benefiting some workers and hurting others, regardless of immigration. Despite a decade-long expansion and a low official jobless rate, the income gap is widening, and many Americans struggle to find stable employment and middle-class wages. A common complaint is that immigrants snatch jobs from native-born Americans, particularly those who did not finish high school. This group is already most likely to earn the minimum wage or be out of work. There is scattershot evidence that in some places immigrants can press down wages at the lowest end of the income scale, but that is not typical. Immigrants take jobs, but they also help create jobs by generating demand for goods and services like groceries, haircuts, and homes. More often, economists say, immigrants complement U.S. workers. More educated women, for example, may decide to work if the availability of immigrants makes child care more affordable. And many tasks that most people previously did themselves, mowing lawns, polishing nails, picking up takeout, driving, are now contracted out because there is labor to do them. The middle class is afforded some luxuries that only the affluent could afford in the past because of immigration, said Muzaffar Chizidi, director of the Migration Policy Institute's office at New York University School of Law. If people are prepared to adjust their needs, we don't need as many immigrants. Choices about how to provide essential services and compensate workers are not just economic but political as well, Chizidi pointed out. Should the government spend more on training, offer workers incentives to relocate, subsidize elder care, protect workers' bargaining power, or help build affordable housing so that low-wage workers can cover basic expenses? What happens now is that migrants tend to fill jobs that citizens do not want to take for the pay offered, and they are much more willing to move to a new city or state for a job. Significantly higher wages might attract more native-born workers to the service jobs that many immigrants occupy in health care, housekeeping, or hothouses, but if labor costs raise the price of tomatoes or a manicure, people will purchase fewer of them. Push-up costs too much, and some jobs might disappear or move to other countries. Overall, income and production would shrink. To many workers, complaints about a labor shortage ring hollow when companies are earning record profits and giving executives multimillion-dollar paychecks while offering workers meager raises. Several businesses, though, have much slimmer profits. Nationwide, for example, restaurant profit margins average 3% to 5%. At one of 50 Eggs' busiest restaurants in Miami, Yardbird Southern Table and Bar, roughly 80% of the staff members were born abroad. The idea that legal immigrants are taking jobs away from residents of the United States is just not reality, said John Kunkel, founder and chief executive of 50 Eggs, which also operates Yardbird locations in Las Vegas, Los Angeles, Dallas, and Singapore. That's the armchair view of somebody who doesn't run a business. Automation, rather than higher wages, is often the response to labor shortages. When immigration restrictions in the mid-1960s dried up the pool of Mexican farm laborers, California growers started using mechanical harvesters to pick tomatoes. And next, companies branded podcast proving to be a hit with consumers. The hit podcast Serial was the audio investigation that launched 1,000 true crime dramas, inspiring podcasters across the country to attempt ambitious reporting projects with gritty subject matter. There were Dirty John and Hollywood and Crime, Death in Ice Valley, and Atlanta Monster. And then there was The Sauce. That three-episode investigative podcast was released last year by the media company Gizmodo and had somewhat lower stakes than the exoneration of a convicted murderer. With an eerie soundtrack meant to recall Serial, the show examined the mystery of how McDonald's underestimated demand for a popular dipping sauce, enraging thousands of its customers. The twist? The hard-boiled investigator scrutinizing that sauce shortage was McDonald's itself. The Sauce was a branded podcast that McDonald's paid Gizmodo to produce as a tongue-in-cheek apology to disappointed customers. While it's no exposé, the show offers a vivid illustration of how companies are increasingly using the tropes of popular podcasts in their own audio projects. These are not advertisements exactly, but subtle brand-building efforts intended to entertain as well as persuade. This year, Facebook began a podcast about entrepreneurship called 3.5 Degrees, and technology companies like Microsoft and Lyft have their own shows. In June, New Balance began collaborating with podcasting company Gimlet on a show about clothing and sneaker culture. You get to catch that busy person where you couldn't normally get them, said Rob Walsh, a vice president at Libsyn, a podcast distributor that works with companies developing branded content. They're listening with earbuds, and you're literally inside their head. By some estimates, there are now as many as 750,000 podcasts, so it's not necessarily a surprise that major companies are creating their own. What's more surprising is that consumers, conditioned to skip past commercials on YouTube and install ad blockers on their browsers, are actually listening to them. Within a day of its release last year, The Sauce broke into iTunes' top 100 podcast chart, reaching number 94. In general, companies have had the most success with shows that are not explicitly about their own products or services. In 2015, for example, General Electric released an 8-part science fiction podcast called The Message that drew millions of listeners and briefly reached number 1 on iTunes. What makes for a successful branded podcast are a lot of the things that make for a successful podcast, period, said Matt Lieber, the president of Gimlet. If a brand wants to make a commercial that's 20 minutes long, it will fail. The exception seems to be Trader Joe's, whose monthly podcast is dedicated entirely to the inner workings of its store. After the first episode last year, Inside Trader Joe's ranked number 5 on the iTunes chart. Companies have tried to reach consumers across a variety of media, from billboards to television commercials. In 1895, John Deere began printing a magazine, The Furrow, sometimes described as the agrarian version of Rolling Stone. Now it has a podcast as well. Over the years, these brand-building experiments have occasionally drawn criticism. In 2016, chip manufacturer Qualcomm released a half-hour commercial directed by an Academy Award winner. The short film raised concerns among some media critics about the blurring line between advertisements and entertainment. Those same concerns may also apply to branded podcasts, said Mark Crispin Miller, a media studies professor at New York University. Propaganda, which after all is what this is, tends to be most successful when it slides into our consciousness without our quite perceiving it, he said in an email. But compared to other advertisements, industry experts say branded podcasts appear relatively benign. Most of the podcasts are pretty transparent, said Matthew Quint, a brand expert at Columbia Business School. It seems to be a very good player amid other cases in which brands in all sorts of ways have their issues in protecting consumers and duping consumers. Branded podcasting actually predates the release of Serial by at least a year. One of the longest-running branded podcasts is an interview show called Keeping You Organized that began in 2013. It's produced by Smeed, a company that manufactures Manila folders. Every week, the show's host, Smeed Marketing Manager John Hunt, interviews a professional organizer about topics like how to efficiently dispose of the scraps left over from cutting coupons out of magazines. It's not that easy to talk about things like file folders, Hunt said, but it is easier for us to talk about organizing. The goal of the McDonald's podcast was not simply to sell more dipping sauce. A few months earlier, the chain had been caught in a public relations nightmare when it severely underestimated consumer demand ahead of the reintroduction of its Szechuan sauce. At some of the chain's locations, fights broke out as customers tussled over the scant supply of sauce packets. The biggest thing that they wanted to get across was that they were very sorry, said Catherine LeClaire, a freelance writer who hosted the show for McDonald's. LeClaire, a vegetarian who rarely eats at the fast food chain, was on the team that came up with the idea to frame the podcast as a spoof of Serial. And next, a convention center update. PNC Arena and the Raleigh Convention Center would get guaranteed tourism money under a plan approved by Wake County leaders last Monday. Missing from the plan was dedicated money for a proposed soccer stadium south of downtown Raleigh. Instead, it will compete against other organizations like Marble's Kid Museum and the NC Museum of Art for a piece of the $46.6 million available to other groups. Wake County and Raleigh leaders also want to jointly study whether the city can support a stadium and its potential impact on the surrounding property. The goal is to have that feasibility study done by December. The Downtown South project, pitched by North Carolina FC and North Carolina Courage owner Steve Malik and Raleigh developer John Kane, requested $330 million. $11 million per year for the next 30 years from the city and county for the project. Their 20,000-seat outdoor stadium could be located on 55 acres around Penmore Drive and South Saunders Street and would be surrounded by private development. The stadium could hold other athletic, musical, and community events, the developers say. The process to receive a portion of that $46.6 million in tourism money hasn't been created yet, but Jessica Holmes, chair of the Wake County Board of Commissioners, promised it would be transparent. PNC Arena would get about $9 million per year until 2034 for improvements to the arena, which could include a rooftop bar, new restaurants, and suites for income-producing spaces. One of the priorities in the plan is an indoor sports complex, and the plan includes a competitive process for that type of facility. The tourism money comes from Wake County's room occupancy and prepared food and beverage taxes. The money can only be used for tourism-related projects. The agreement also has to be approved by the Raleigh City Council, which is expected to vote on it at their 1 p.m. meeting last Tuesday. One change made during the meeting involved money to help the city lure a significant hotel to downtown. The plan includes $2.2 million a year for Raleigh parking and infrastructure for the Raleigh Convention Center that can be used as a negotiating tool to lure a hotel. The original agreement said the city manager and county manager and the Raleigh City Council would have to approve the negotiations. However, Wake County Commissioner Vicki Adamson requested that the county commissioners also approve the negotiations to be consistent with the other projects. That board unanimously approved the change, though Wake County Manager David Ellis said that could potentially hold up negotiations between a hotel and the city. After the meeting, Adamson said she wasn't concerned about holdups. If it's a good deal today, it should be a good deal tomorrow, she said. Assistant Manager Jim Green said that he had no comment about the change after Monday's meeting. Here's a breakdown of the tourism money the county approved plan would give the convention center. About $3 million per year for maintenance, a one-time $5 million for convention center upgrades, a one-time $14 million to buy land near the convention center for an expansion in 2020, and about $2.57 million a year starting in 2025 for a Raleigh Music Venue relocation. And this would likely be moving Red Hat Amphitheater to another location for a convention center expansion. We have run out of time for today's episode of Money Matters. I hope you've enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Pat Perry, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's reading of Money Matters is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.